Welcome to the Contributing Factor Podcast, where we take you even deeper into the no-spin zone. I'm your host, Robert Samuel, a producer here at the O'Reilly Factor. In this episode, we're going to take a closer look at how the White House Chief of Staff position shapes the presidency. The White House Chief of Staff is appointed by the president and does not require Senate confirmation, yet it's been called the second most powerful job in the federal government. If the president is the CEO of the executive branch, the Chief of Staff position is thought of as the Chief Operating Officer. In this episode, Ed Henry, Fox News Chief National Correspondent and author of the new book 42 Faith, the rest of the Jackie Robinson story, discusses how Donald Trump's Chief of Staff Reince Priebus is handling the job, as well as his observations on previous Chiefs of Staff he covered as White House Correspondent. But first is my interview with Chris Whipple, author of the new book The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. Here's my conversation with Chris. So Chris, the first organization to have a chief of staff was the Prussian military in the early 1800s. They created it in response to a defeat by Napoleon's army. The U.S. military then adopted what became the modern Joint Chiefs of Staff system in the Theodore Roosevelt administration in the early 1900s. But a president didn't have a chief of staff until Sherman Adams served in the Dwight Eisenhower administration. Both Presidents Kennedy and Johnson didn't have a chief of staff, but then it was President Richard Nixon who really created the modern White House organization structure under Chief of Staff H.R. Haldeman. Richard Nixon, of course, resigned over Watergate, and Haldeman served 18 months in prison for his role in the cover-up. So why is Nixon's White House credited with this organizational triumph when that presidency did not end well at all?
H.R. Bob Haldeman, who's a fascinating character because, you know, the irony of this guy who became the poster boy for Watergate, the biggest scandal in American history, and yet all of his successors credit him as being the guy who wrote the template for the empowered modern White House Chief of Staff. And it's largely because Haldeman, who also pretty much invented the modern presidential campaign, the use of television as an advance man for Nixon, Haldeman was obsessed with it. Now, Haldeman studied everything he could get his hands on, and he created the system. He took, the system that Sherman Adams did for Eisenhower, Ike's chief of staff, took it to a whole new level. I mean, the ultimate gatekeeper who creates time and space for a president to think, which was important for Nixon. The president's pluperfect son of a bitch. and that was what they called him.
Yeah.
And he was tough on the furniture. He was pretty rough on the staff, and in that sense, not ideal as a chief, but he wrote the book.
Yeah, the non-chief of staff model is kind of the spoke and wheel model where 8 or 9 different White House advisors report to the president. Why do you think that didn't work? And subsequent presidents have briefly tried that. Carter didn't have a chief of staff for the first years of his administration, has tried this spoke and wheel. And I guess as a part two to that is, why can't the president run the White House? It's just a weird thing. One of the points you make in your thing, if he's not running the White House, what is the president doing?
It can't be done. It's just too complex. And as Jimmy Carter discovered the hard way, you know, when you schedule the White House tennis court and you correct typos and memos and you try to do everything yourself, you have absolutely no time or space in which to think. You're learning by fire hose, as somebody put it. That's the way Gerald Ford was described when he had this crazy notion that he could continue to do what he did as minority leader in the Senate. And he would have something called the spokes of the wheel, 5 or 6 equal advisors reporting, coming and going from the White House as they pleased. It was a disaster. It took him about a month to figure that out, that he couldn't prioritize. You need a chief of staff to do a number of things. But you really need, ultimately, you need somebody to give the president space and time to think, to make decisions. And you can't do it, as every president has learned, often the hard way, without an empowered chief of staff.
Yeah, and the analogy you make in the book is that the president is the CEO and the chief of staff is the COO. And like we said, unconfirmed position, you don't have to get approval from the Senate for the chief of staff position. Do you think there's any danger to how powerful the chief of staff is, given that he just serves at the pleasure of the president and that's it?
Now, I think the greater danger is when you do not have an empowered chief of staff. When you do not have a chief of staff who's playing the gatekeeper, you know, one of the reasons that Watergate was such a disaster is that Chuck Colson figured out how to get around the chief of staff and come and go from the White House, mm-hmm. and was turned loose on these illegal projects. It's a much more dangerous situation when you have a White House in chaos. Sound familiar?
We'll talk about Trump in a minute.
It's a much more dangerous situation when you don't have a chief of staff who's not only acting as the gatekeeper and as the president's confidant, but also someone who is the so-called honest broker, who ensures that the paper flow, the information flow to the president, presents every side of every issue, keep everything except the most difficult decisions out of his office. That's how you govern. Mm-hmm. Governing is tough. I mean, it's got nothing to do with running a real estate firm in Manhattan. It is much more complicated, and you can't run it according to the chaos management theory of having a whole bunch of advisors at each other's throats.
One of the interesting things in your book is the names that keep popping up. Dick Cheney was chief of staff to Gerald Ford, and so was Donald Rumsfeld. Cheney, of course, became George W. Bush's vice president, and Rumsfeld was George W. Bush's secretary of defense. Leon Panetta, chief of staff to Bill Clinton, later became Barack Obama's CIA director and defense secretary. Rahm Emanuel, Barack Obama's first chief of staff, is now mayor of Chicago. So many chiefs of staff go on to hold very prominent positions. But perhaps the most interesting transformation is Dick Cheney's. I was very surprised to read in your book that the press loved Cheney when he was Ford's chief of staff and he was considered a very affable guy. He's, of course, now known as Darth Vader for his role in the Iraq War and the War on Terror. Why was he so well-loved then, and what happened to him?
It's a great untold story, and it's kind of almost a parlor game among the chiefs themselves, who often say, what the heck happened to that guy? Well, that guy, 34-year-old Dick Cheney.
Yeah, so young.
Who became chief of staff when he was 34, was the life of the party. He was the most popular guy in Washington. He was a straight shooter with the press corps. He was a guy that you wanted in the room when there was a tough issue to help reach consensus. He was self-effacing. It's been a kind of a mystery as to what happened to his best friend, Brent Scowcroft, until the Iraq War, when they had a real falling out, is convinced that it was his heart condition. That's what a bad heart will do to you. There are other theories. One is that he went to the dark side, as it were, when he was CEO of Halliburton.
The defense contracting firm, yeah.
Another theory is 9/11. I think there's something to the 9/11 theory, but I also think that Cheney, when he became Bush's vice president, it was his final stop in his political career. He had no further ambitions. He didn't have to be nice to anybody. He could tell them exactly what they thought.
And he knew so much about the chief of staff position. You talk about how important to empower the chief of staff. He actually went around the chief of staff because he knew how it worked while he was vice president.
Well, I think Andy Card,
who was
George Bush 43's chief of staff, had Mission Impossible. This is a guy who was up against a couple of very shrewd, seasoned operatives in Don Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense and Dick Cheney, who was invested with all kinds of power by Bush 43. Bush 43 did not want a powerful chief of staff in the mold of Jim Baker, the chief that Reagan had.
And came back for George H.W. Bush, yeah.
Yeah. He didn't want that, for better or worse, I would argue for worse, because he overestimated his ability to manage the White House. And I think that, you know, Colin Powell is convinced, the Secretary of State under 43, Colin Powell is convinced that Cheney's outsized influence came at the expense of Andy Card's ability to act as an honest broker, for example, in the Iraq War.
Yeah, and you mentioned Jim Baker. Would you say he was the most effective chief of staff? Because Ronald Reagan came in a little bit like Trump, not entirely. I mean, he had 8 years experience as governor. He had lost a presidential run, so he had been in the game much longer than Trump before 2016. But Reagan was thought to be, you know, a little bit of a wacko, maybe, had some strange thoughts about nuclear weapons, but it turns out maybe he actually was a nuclear abolitionist, but no one knew that at the time. But then he hires James Baker, the Washington insider, the pragmatist, as his chief of staff. Would you say that putting policy completely aside, but if you wanted to get policy accomplished, would you want a figurehead like Reagan and an operative like Baker? Is that the model?
Well, Reagan was more than a figurehead. I mean, he was not a puppet on James Baker's strings by any means. But having the courage to choose Jim Baker, who, after all, was had led the campaign of the campaigns of his rivals, George H.W. Yeah. Bush and Gerald Ford before that, was a courageous act by Reagan. He did it because Nancy and Stu Spencer, the veteran Republican campaign manager, persuaded him that Baker wasn't out for himself, but would be out for Reagan. It was a masterstroke by Reagan. Think about Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan for a second, two outsider presidents. Carter, an outsider to be sure.
Yeah,
Georgia. Possibly the most intelligent president on paper elected in the 20th century. Ronald Reagan was famously called an amiable dunce, mm-hmm. unfairly. But Reagan intuited something Carter never understood. And by the way, Trump doesn't get it either.
Huh. Yeah.
He understood that an outsider president needs a consummate insider to help make things work.
Yeah, I don't know if it was your words or some other quote about it, but it really summed it up, is that Carter knew far more than Reagan, but Reagan understood more. But, I apologize. I've been checking my phone constantly because the O'Reilly Factor is about to go live on the air. But I got to get you one more question before we stop here. Trump. He does not seem to have empowered Reince Priebus, his chief of staff, to run the White House. He likes this creative tension. Do you think there's any way that a White House can be run the way Trump is doing now? Because, of course, he had a number of setbacks on health care, on the travel ban early. But lately, he's had a number of foreign policy successes. The Syria strike, the Afghanistan bombing was seen, at least his supporters liked that quite a bit. And now in Korea, the missile launch failed. So is there any way that maybe Trump has some sort of savant-like managerial genius that he can pull it off and no one else can?
The short answer is no. it can't be done. History shows that it can't be done. History shows that every president learns often the hard way that you cannot govern effectively without an empowered White House chief of staff. And lobbing a few missiles onto a Syrian airstrip doesn't change the fact that this is the most dysfunctional White House in modern history. No competent White House chief of staff would send an executive order on immigration out without vetting it with the appropriate departments. But it all fundamentally comes back to Trump, and as it always comes back to the president. The president has to decide that he wants to empower a chief to not only to do all these things we've talked about, but to be the grown-up in the room and tell you what you don't want to hear.
Yeah, well, Trump certainly seems to have learned some things from being president so far. He's changed some things, but whether he learns as much as you advise here and to empower his chief of staff will certainly be very interesting as his presidency goes on. But once again, the book is The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency by Chris Whipples. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Chris Whipple. Up next is my interview with Ed Henry, Fox News' chief national correspondent. So, Ed, thanks for coming on the show again so quickly after your last appearance. But I wanted to have you on to talk about chiefs of staff in the White House. You were a White House correspondent for quite a long time, beginning in 2006 when you worked for another network. I've known some people that have worked in White Houses. I've talked to a number of journalists who've covered White Houses. And one of the reoccurring themes when I have discussions about the White House is how powerful chiefs of staffs are in White Houses, regardless of who holds the position. Do you have a similar opinion on that?
Yeah, I have a very strong view that the chief of staff has to be the first among equals. It, maybe the whip hand, whatever you want to call it, because I do think that they have to be tough. They have to be tough about guarding the Oval Office, not letting people just pop in there. I mean, quick example, early Clinton years, Mac McClarty was an old buddy of Bill Clinton. I think he became effective over time, but at first he was sort of run over by all these different advisors who were just popping into the Oval Office, letting meetings go on for 3 hours, changing the president's mind at the end after a decision had already been made. You got to have somebody who is strong, is tough, guards the president's time and space like a hawk. But then you also need somebody who, it's somewhat contradictory, but it has to be tough as nails, say with Capitol Hill, with outside people. But then sometimes, of course, has to kind of bring people along, go along, get along. But you can't be one or the other. You can't just be constantly the tough cop, and you can't be constantly, the buddy-buddy person like with Capitol Hill. You have to do both with the hill, but inside you got to be super tough.
And as far as how the job works, the analogy you often hear is the president is the CEO mm-hmm. and the chief of staff is the COO, chief operating officer. Do you agree with that analogy?
I agree with that. And I think that's one of the challenges for President Trump, because I think based on how he's run his businesses, he wants to be the CEO and the COO. Uh-huh. So to use your analogy, Reince Priebus is caught between
the current chief of staff,
a couple of issues. One is he has a boss who wants to be the chief of staff in some ways. I don't want to exaggerate it, but Donald Trump is very hands-on. I mean, you don't have to take it from me. Look at his Twitter account. You know,
right.
This, that, bam, boom. We're going to move this. We're going to move that. He's all over everything. That can be good, but sometimes he has to sort of take his hand off the wheel and let the chief of staff drive things. And so far, Reince Priebus hasn't shown the ability to be that tough cop, both with the president saying, hey, I've got this. You go be the CEO or maybe even chairman of the board, the big picture guy. And secondly, Reince Priebus has a challenge of this whole issue of a circle of chiefs of staff or a circle mm-hmm. of big advisors. Jared Kushner, for example, the president's son-in-law. His title may be senior advisor, but he's the president's son-in-law,
right.
Number one. So he has
hard
the president's
to fire here. Him.
Yeah. Hard to be fired. Hard for the chief of staff, Reince Priebus, in fairness to him, to say, Jared, you're not doing the right thing there. Or Jared, I don't think that's going to help the president. He's the president's son-in-law. So that's a unique challenge. And I think he's somebody who's also run businesses, Jared. So he's not used to being subservient to someone else like a Reince Priebus.
Yeah, Chris Whipple, the other guest that was on the podcast earlier, author of this new book called The Gatekeepers about Chiefs of Staff, he was critical of just how the Trump White House is set up, that Trump seems to like creative tension amongst his advisors, that he wants to see them arguing with one another and playing off one another. And that Whipple, you know, from his study of history of other chiefs of staff, thinks there really needs to be one person in charge. I mean, what's
your
reaction to that?
I largely agree with that. I mean, I think, you know, to go back to the president's business life, you know, having competing views is not such a bad thing in a boardroom, for example, so that you don't miss something. Uh-huh. You know, it's good to have another view, another side. And you've got to argue that out in the White House. You have to, you know, if you want to repeal and replace Obamacare, it's good to have a dissenting voice. But then once that decision is made, this is the bill we're going to back. You need a chief of staff who's going to be tough as nails to not let people inside the White House undermine that bill or that law, number one. And number two, you need a chief of staff who's really going to go to Capitol Hill and sell these things. With Reince Priebus, another challenge is when he was the chairman of the Republican National Committee, he was subservient to Speaker Paul Ryan and mm-hmm. the majority leader and others, because he was asking their help to raise campaign money and go out and stump for the president and this and that. Now, all of a sudden, he's been thrust into the role of, we need to do this, Mr. Speaker. Like, mm-hmm. this is what the president wants. That's hard to make that transition. I would flip it around a little bit and give you another view, which is Andy Card. That was the first chief of staff I covered in the Bush White House. No chief of staff is perfect, but I found him to be a fairly effective chief of staff because he was self-effacing. He didn't need the credit himself. But he was tough in terms of guarding that Oval Office and not letting people go in through the side door and chew the president's ear and say, what about this? Mm-hmm. They had to go through the chief of staff. And Andy Card was good at laying down the law. But I also think he was very good at something that the Trump White House is also missing, delivering bad news. Mm-hmm. Andy Card was known as someone, George W. Bush had a temper. And didn't always like it. He wanted to do things a certain way. I mean, wasn't one of his books a book, or maybe it was a book about him, I remember when I was covering him, Dead Certain.
Right,
I do remember at a news conference that the president, in pushing back on me when I was pressing him about Donald Rumsfeld's performance, said, Ed, I'm the decider, right? So here's a guy who's declared, I'm the decider, I'm in charge here. And when you tell him, hey, this is not going well, hey, you got to do something different, that's hard. Andy Card was not afraid to deliver bad news to George W. Bush. The jury is still out on whether Reince Priebus and Jared Kushner and others are able to do that in this White House.
Yeah, with Andy Card, do you think he struggled in that Dick Cheney, who was George W. Bush's vice president, and also Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, they had previously been chief of staff, both to Gerald Ford. So they knew how to work.
Back to my previous point that no chief of staff is perfect. Andy Card had some of his own blind spots. And to that point might be, you know, Cheney and Rumsfeld knew where the bodies were buried. You know, they had been chiefs of staff, as you say, back, you know, in like Ford days, and they knew how to maneuver the bureaucracy. And that's something Reince Priebus, I'm sure, is dealing with all the time. putting aside unique challenges in this White House, any chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, to take Ryan's side of it for a minute, Rahm Emanuel was tough as nails Obama's first chief of staff. I covered him on the Hill, and then I covered him even before that in the Clinton White House as a mid-level senior aide. But as chief of staff, he was tough as nails, but was constantly looking over his shoulder because Valerie Jarrett was going to the president. Mm-hmm. Valerie Jarrett was a very powerful senior advisor who would go to the first lady sometimes and say, mm-hmm. are you sure this is the best thing for the president? And that could be really undermining of the chief of staff. So no one has a perfect lock on it. But I have to say, I'm not just pulling this out of thin air. I had a long conversation this week with somebody who speaks to the president by phone and meets with him in person, but is an outside advisor who the president very much trusts, has known a long time. And this person told me that President Trump really needs more of a Rahm Emanuel type. Even if you don't like Rahm Emanuel, that Rahm Emanuel was tough. He was a fighter. He'd get his hands dirty on the Hill in a way that President Obama didn't want to, because he sort of like waved his hand at the Hill, like, I don't want to have to deal with these lawmakers in both parties. President Obama, you know, much more quiet, self-effacing, behind the scenes. He'd go out and do his public rallies. He just didn't really like the jawboning with lawmakers. He really looked down on the process, thought it would dirty him. And so Emanuel was the real effective, like, how do you think they got Obamacare passed?
Right.
Yeah, the president made the public case, but Emanuel was behind the scenes working those phones, threatening people sometimes, but to my point at the beginning, cajoling them sometimes too. Like, hey, can you help me on this? There's a lot of bargaining that needs to be done. And so this advisor to President Trump told me he thinks there needs to be someone like Emanuel, a former lawmaker, a governor. But frankly, there's no one of that stature right now in the Republican Party that's an obvious pick. Chris Christie is one whose name comes up, but Bridgegate, his frosty relationship with Jared Kushner, there are other strikes against him coming into the White House. But just in isolation, putting those issues aside, a Chris Christie type, he's faced the voters before. He's tough. He's done town hall meetings. You may not always like him, but he's willing to tell it to you straight. And you know what? Chris Christie, behind closed doors, I bet you, would tell it to the president. Hey, your stuff stinks right now. You got to change this. He would not be afraid to tell the president that.
Yeah, one of the points Whipple makes in his book is that it's tough for a principal type to become chief of staff, a governor or a senator.
No doubt.
There's the chief part.
You're used to being the boss, and now you're subservient to the president of the United States. However, I think based on our entire conversation, the only shade of difference I'd say to that theory is, as we've been laying it out, an effective chief of staff is still the boss. Your analogy at the beginning is still applicable, which is, okay, you've been a governor. Now you're not in charge because you have the president hanging over you. But if you're a real COO, at Goldman Sachs or ExxonMobil, you're a very, very powerful man or woman who is in charge of things and running things. And I would argue that as chief of staff, it's still a big, big job because you're essentially running the entire federal government.
Yeah.
Again, I don't think the Trump White House has gotten its arms quite around how much vast power they really have.
Yeah.
And so they've got all these people fighting behind the scenes, and they don't have one person, we've probably used 30 different analogies, but maybe driving the train.
Yeah.
I talked about grabbing the steering wheel. There's not one person really steering it right now.
And do you think, you said you've talked to this advisor, but do you think Trump himself realizes all of this and that he will
make some
changes?
Based on conversations he had with this advisor and others that I've been privy to, he realizes they have to make adjustments. He's just trying to figure out, I think the president, number one, is loath to have a complete house cleaning because he's still stung by the pushing out, bringing on General Flynn and then pushing him out as national security advisor. That led to even more stories about chaos and crisis in the White House. You have a large cleaning of the house, if you will, at the end of the first 100 days or on day 101, and you're going to have a wave more stories, that say that you're in chaos. On the other hand, the mainstream media is going to sort of write that story about this president no matter what he does, that he's chaos and crisis. He's gotten a lot of negative coverage, whether he deserves it or not. End of the day, he's going to make some moves. He's going to retool this in the weeks ahead.
Yeah. Do you think he's done anything already? Because it seems like he's had some more successes of late. I mean, at the gate, you mentioned General Flynn was fired very early. Healthcare was at least a short-term failure. There's also the travel bans are blocked right now. But recently, Korea has been seen as sort of, Trump as a success. There was the Syria bombing. We'll see what happens with that. But that was certainly seen as—
having covered a lot of presidents in both parties, what I'd say one of the best things President Trump has going for him, whether you're a fan or not, is that things have gone somewhat badly recently. Because every president I've covered, the media in general, or sometimes the public, not just to pick on the media, when a president is written off is sometimes when they're at their best.
Right.
I mean, I remember, you know,
lower the expectations.
I wasn't the daily White House correspondent, but I was a young reporter in Washington covering Bill Clinton and his White House. Mm-hmm. And you're right, expectations are lowered. Think about it. He had a bruising health care loss like Donald Trump did early on. And mm-hmm. people were saying, he's done. Then he has one of the worst midterm elections ever. Has to say, like, the president is still relevant at a news conference because they're saying, you know, the Congress is now
running Gingrich the show. Newt Gingrich is going to do everything.
Newt Gingrich is in charge, which was ridiculous, but that was the narrative, right? And Bill Clinton had to, like, prove that he was still in charge. And then the first big speech to a joint session of Congress, the State of the Union or whatever it was, he had to say the era of big government is over for a liberal like Bill Clinton. Although he was centrist on other things, but a big government Democrat to say the era of big government is over was a big deal. He did that under duress because the Republicans were now in power. But guess what? All of a sudden, he started getting all kinds of things done. There were smaller initiatives, the school uniforms. He got mocked, but he got things done. And guess what? He got reelected.
Yeah.
People seem to forget that. And so when these presidents are battered, and he had staff fights. George Stephanopoulos was the first guy at the podium. He had sort of a horrible debut. The media wrote him off, wrote the president off. They moved Stephanopoulos into a behind-the-scenes job, mm-hmm. not in front of the camera. Guess what? He did pretty well for the president. And last I checked, George Stephanopoulos is still in front of the camera doing a good job, right?
That's right.
So I would always be careful that I think at some point there'll be some staff shakeups. There'll be some new people brought in. This president will learn from mistakes in the first 100 days.
Yeah.
And things are going to turn around for him. I've seen it. And I'm not saying that to root for. I'm saying Democrats, Republicans, Clinton, Bush, Obama. Every time presidents are written off, you're right, expectations come down. They retool. They think it over. And not every time, but most times they rebound.
Yeah, I think a year before Barack Obama's reelection, there was a Nate Silver New York Times Magazine article that said he had 17% chance to win. I mean, presidents in general are reelected. George H.W. Bush.
Vast executive power. Yeah, the power of the megaphone. And think about this president in particular, Donald Trump. Have we seen another president who can better, more effectively use that megaphone?
Yeah.
I mean, he proved in the campaign when he was written off time and time again that he won. Now, of course, there were mistakes on the Democratic side. It wasn't all because of the megaphone. But the fact of the matter is, you know, not just the lesson I learned covering the White House about presidents being at their strongest when we think they're the weakest. Think about this president. How many times was he counted out in 2016?
Right. And, you know, looking at since Reagan, I think only George H.W. Bush is the only one that did not win
re-election.
And Trump obviously has shown a willingness to modify his position.
And a resilience. And again, this is, you go back to the business analogy, and this hasn't been tested really in the White House, but a business leader being mm-hmm. elected. How many times did he file for bankruptcy? How many times was he written off as a businessman? Again, I'm not saying it's a direct analogy. Governing, as he's found in the first 100 days, is harder than The Apprentice. It's harder than, you know, rolling out a new hotel, a new golf course. I'm not saying it's a direct analogy, but I would say the people who write off President Trump seem to forget that this is a man who's been down many times before in the business world, has retooled, has brought in new people, has fixed the mistakes he made, and comes back stronger.
Yeah, and you know, Steve Bannon seems to have lost a little bit of influence in the White House. Mm-hmm. We'll see how that affects things. But I mean, Trump's, we should say, his approval ratings are pretty low for the first 100 days.
Absolutely, and he's made mistakes. He's had stumbles. Some of the big initiatives like repealing and replacing Obamacare seem to be stalled, as does cutting taxes and reforming the tax code.
Yeah, the tax thing's going to be big,
If he can't deal with either or both of those in the next 3 to 6 months, what kind of victories does he have? He is reaching a critical point in his presidency, and I hate to say, because every time a president has a big vote or something, but the fact of the matter is he's not going to, without those two battles being won, how does he move on to, say, infrastructure spending and win on that? Yeah. He has a whole list of things he wants to get done, and he seems to be on the legislative front a bit stalled, and that's why I think you hear the name of, say, a Kevin McCarthy, the House Majority Leader. He's been floated as a potential chief of staff. I'm not sure he has sort of the gusto and the sort of, you know, break the legs on the Hill. He's more of a go-along, get-along. Mm-hmm. But back to my point about Rahm Emanuel, he may need somebody, whether it's chief of staff or senior advisor, who frankly has government experience. Even Reince Priebus, as chief of staff, was at the RNC, not the government. Jared Kushner, no government experience. Steve Bannon, hey, he helped win a campaign. Kellyanne Conway, they helped him get there, but neither of them have ever governed.
Yeah, Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, there are some parallels to Obama already, especially Obama's second term when he couldn't get anything passed in Congress. He just started turning to these executive orders. We'll see how Trump responds to that. But I know
it's almost like he's gone to that first. Obama did that after all else was lost.
He kind of gave up
so
Congress.
Maybe will this president do the opposite, President Trump? Start with a lot of this flurry of executive activity that he learned, I think you're right, from the Obama days, but now really get the hands dirty and get stuff passed on the Hill. That's going to determine whether he gets reelected.
Yeah, and I know we got to get out of here, but I wanted to ask you about your book again. We already had a podcast. Please listen to that one, because the entire previous podcast that Ed was on is about his book.
We had so much traffic from the podcast, and
I really
appreciate it.
Oh,
absolutely. I saw it on social media, and I have to say we debuted at number 4 on the Washington Post bestsellers list in large part because of this podcast and the O'Reilly Factor being on there talking about the book.
I knew it was doing well. I didn't know it was doing that well. That's great. Yeah. And we should say the name is 42 Faith, The Rest of the Jackie Robinson Story. Something I wanted to ask you is, what is it like to be on a book tour? I saw you in Los Angeles over the weekend. Is it like super stressful, or is it like, oh my gosh, I'm like selling my book in Los Angeles, California? This is like, I feel like a bigwig. Like,
the latter part is better, you know, because you're stressed throughout it, because a lot of it is on a shoestring and you're traveling around and you're doing a string of interviews, but you have to stop yourself every once in a while and say, hey, I've got the book is done. The heavy lifting.
Yeah.
Nothing on the tour could be as hard as actually writing, editing, rewriting the book. And so when you're walking into an interview, you're stressed, you're in traffic, you're jumping out of an Uber, when you reach down and you grab the book that's a finished product and you're like, I'm in Los Angeles. I'm going to the Dodgers game to talk about Jackie Robinson. It's cool. And I'll give you a quick story, which is I needed a haircut. I walked by a barbershop in L.A. I go in there and there's an African-American man. This is obviously about Jackie Robinson, the first African-American player. For some reason, this guy kept, you know, saying, how you doing? What are you doing in Los Angeles? He's just very talkative. Mm-hmm. His name's Rico. I know that because then we got to know each other. So I sit down next to him and he turns out he was a high school basketball player in Los Angeles. My point is, I finally say, hey, by the way, I just wrote this book about Jackie Robinson. He said, you're not going to believe this. I said, what? He said, my godmother's mother married this guy, Ray Bartlett, who was in the same backfield as Jackie Robinson on UCLA.
Oh, wow. Because Robinson's
college.
From Pasadena.
He's from Pasadena. And then they both went to play for the Honolulu Bears, a semi-pro football team in the 40s. And I said, yeah, Jackie was there, but he left right before Pearl Harbor. And he said, yeah, you did your research. He said, but guess what? When my godmother's mother married Ray Bartlett, Jackie was the best man.
Oh, wow.
So he went home and got the marriage certificate, which has been bequeathed to him. And he came to my book party that night with the marriage certificate. And I introduced him. I say it because we were two guys who had never known each other. I think this is one of those, you know, comes down from God. Because this man, Rico, starts talking to me at a barbershop. And I was thinking, do I tell him about the book? You know what? It sounds weird. Like, I have a book out. I wouldn't do it. But then he kept talking. He said, well, what are you doing here? He seemed so I said, you know what? I just wrote this book. That's why I'm here. And he said, you know, my godmother's mother, Jackie Robinson, was best man at her wedding.
That's wild.
So it was sort of like this incredible connection. You have those kind of things out there in the country, it makes you feel really good.
Yeah. Well, the book is 42 Faith, The Rest of the Jackie Robinson Story, and it's still a very good book. I can confirm that.
I appreciate that.
And thanks so much for
taking
the time.
Thanks for having me on, Robert.
And that's it for today's episode. Before we go, a quick reminder of the benefits of a premium membership on BillO'Reilly.com. If you join now, you can get any one of Bill's books for free, including Old School, Life in the Sane Lane. Once again, this is Robert Samuel for the Contributing Factor Podcast. Please check out our future posts on BillO'Reilly.com, iTunes, and the Google Play Store.